Call the meeting of the Committee on Capital Investments order. First order of business members up today is the Minnesota Department of Transportation overview. So we will call on Ms. Hatch. If you identify yourself to the team, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tracy Hatch. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'm here today to present to you our 2013 bonding needs. And before I begin, I just want to give you a little bit of a sort of a context for what I'm about to present. These are preliminary agency needs. These are not governor's recommendations. These are not in any priority order. And we also have not included any trunk highway requests at this time. The first item I'd like to present to you is related to our turnbacks. We currently have about $50 million annually from the flexible highway account, which receives 53.5% of the 95% distribution to the highway user tax distribution fund. This account is currently used to improve trunk highways that no longer serve a trunk highway purpose, and then to allow them to be turned back to the city or county in an acceptable condition. Some turnbacks are initiated at the request of MnDOT, while other turnbacks are initiated at the request of the local authority. These turnback funds are used for construction of the route to be turned back and to improve it to a standard that can be turned back to the locals and have minimum impact on them for at least a reasonable life cycle. We have negotiated a managed backlog of turnbacks and have received some mutual agreement with locals on those projects. These are regionally significant projects, and they do turn the road back to the locals, giving them full control over the road. So we are looking for $100 million in supplemental funding to support this program. The second item is the local bridge program, which I think you're probably all familiar with. We have a current need for approximately $20 million to fund replacing deficient local bridges and accelerated bridge construction. The average bridge replacement cost is about $310,000, so this represents about 60 local bridges that could be replaced. Just to give you a little bit more context about the local bridge program, these state bridge replacement funds are used in two ways. The first way is to leverage or supplement other types of bridge replacement funding, such as federal aid, state aid, and township bridge funds. Federal aid funds provide up to 80% of the bridge funding for eligible projects, with the local governments responsible for paying the matching funds. On the state aid system, these funds are used to share in the cost of bridge replacement, and on the township system, these funds are used only when the county has depleted its town bridge account. In these cases, these funds are used for 100% replacement of the eligible construction costs. The second way these funds are utilized is to provide funds for bridges that have no other source of federal or state aid funds. For example, a bridge that's less than 20 feet long are not eligible for federal funds. The local road improvement program, we are looking for $30 million in additional funding for that program. This provides grants to counties for rural road safety. In 2011, we had applications, 154 applications requesting $63 million. We had received $10 million in funds in 2011. We selected 28 projects and leveraged an additional $20 million in local and federal funds. In 2012, we received $10 million in funds, and those funds were committed to two separate projects, Oak Park Heights Utilities on the Trunk Highway 36 River Crossing and Turnback in Scott County on Trunk Highway 101. A little more context about this program is that this request would provide funding assistance to local agencies for construction, reconstruction, or reconditioning projects on local roads with statewide or regional significance and projects on the county-state highway system. State assistance is needed to supplement the local effort and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund in financing capital improvements to preserve and develop a balanced transportation system throughout the state. There are currently three accounts in the Local Road Improvement Fund. The Trunk Highway Corridor Projects account provides funding assistance to local agencies with the local share of costs for improving the trunk highways throughout their communities. The Local Road account for routes of regional significance provides funding assistance to local agencies for road projects that are significant to the state or to the region. These projects support economic development, provide capacity or congestion relief, provide connections to interregional corridors and other major highways, or eliminate hazards. The local road account for rural road safety provides funding for projects on county state aid highways intended to reduce traffic crashes, deaths, injuries, and damage to property.
Excuse me, Ms. Hatch. Members, we have a quorum, so Representative Swedinski, have you read the minutes from February 21st?
Yes, I have.
Would you move to approve those?
I move that we accept the minutes.
Representative Swedinski moves that we approve the minutes from February 21st. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative David, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Ms. Hatch, as we look at the handout where it says introduction, it says does not reflect the governor's recommendation. You are part of the executive branch. When will you reflect the governor's recommendations?
Ms. Hatch?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not certain exactly what the governor's timeline is for issuing recommendations or if he'll issue them at all. So with that knowledge, we were asked to just present what our needs are at the current time, and the governor's office said that was appropriate for us to present our needs. As you know, he's going to have a lot of requests across the state that he'll have to balance, and so I'm not sure which of these might make it into his final recommendation package, if there is one. But at this time, these are just MnDOT's needs for the current year.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hatch. Mr. Chairman, are you aware of any date when the governor is going to propose his recommendation?
Representative Davids, we're waiting for that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Proceed, Ms. Hatch, with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The next item I'd like to present to you is related to our modal investments. Actually, the next few items are related to our modal investment areas. The first one is for aeronautics. We are seeking $2 million to construct or upgrade radio navigation aids, approach lighting systems, runway lights, and weather systems to serve the state's publicly owned airports. This is offset by a cancellation that we have for $2 million of a previous appropriation from 2009. The reason, it's a complicated reason, we'd be happy to go into great detail with you, but to provide you kind of a high-level context for why we were looking to cancel those $2 million from the 2009 appropriation is that those funds were originally provided to fill a radar gap that currently exists over west central Minnesota. And over the past several years, MnDOT has been working with the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, to implement a system to achieve that goal, and some of the technology has changed, and some of the federal requirements have changed, and some of the federal recommendations for what to put in that location have changed. And so as a result of many negotiations and a lot of research, as well as ongoing operations and maintenance challenges, state bonding rules and FAA requirements, both the FAA and MnDOT have agreed that there are limited benefits to the system that we should have implemented according to FAA rules, which is the ADS-B system. That stands for Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast System, and that implementation of that system at this time for MnDOT and for that area is not prudent and a prudent use of state resources. So we'd like to go in a different direction, and with $2 million to replace the $2 million bond authorization we had before, we could move ahead with a different approach. The next item is in the Greater Minnesota Transit area. This is a $4 million need for capital improvements to public transit facilities. The three kind of main areas that we would be utilizing this funding for is transit operations centers, bus storage and maintenance facilities, and other transit facilities. Essentially, there are three kind of funding priorities, if you will, for this program. One is to provide vehicles for Greater Minnesota Transit or replace those vehicles. The second is to provide facilities to support vehicles and programs, such as maintenance facilities and housing facilities. And the third is auxiliary procurement, such as maintenance, training, and administrative offices. These capital improvement projects are part of an annual solicitation that is vetted through MnDOT's capital improvement process. This determines the program eligibility, appropriate scale and scope, fiscal impact to operations, and the recipient's capacity to complete the project on time and on budget. Candidate projects for this type of facility currently are in transit operation centers would be St. Cloud, Phase 3 in Mankato, and Duluth. In terms of bus storage and maintenance facilities, some candidates currently are the Rainbow Rider in Grant County in Elbow Lake, and the Kandy, Ohio Area Transit Facility in Wilmer. Other transit facilities, transfer hubs, include the City of Rochester, and then smaller projects in other Greater Minnesota communities. We are seeking 27 million.
Excuse me. Could you provide the committee with a list of, you know, the candidates?
Mr. Chair, members, absolutely. You're looking for the Greater Minnesota Transit?
Correct.
Yes, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
The next request is regarding intercity passenger rail. This is a need for $27 million in GO bonds to support planning, design, environmental work, engineering, and construction for the passenger rail system as identified in the state passenger rail plan. This includes four main projects: the Twin Cities to Milwaukee high-speed rail corridor, the Northern Lights Express, the Rochester Zip Rail high-speed rail corridor, and adding a second daily train to Chicago. There are other corridor developments or system projects that could be funded from this as well. The next slide, you'll see a list of those projects I just mentioned, as well as how the funding of the $27 million would be used in both fiscal years 13 and 14, as well as fiscal years 15 and 16. For example, the Twin Cities to Milwaukee high-speed rail corridor would be a state match for the preliminary design and engineering components of that project.
Ms. Hatch, we have a question. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hatch, looking at the map, to the west of Minneapolis-St. Paul, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot there. What's that blue arrow going up to the northwest? Is that North Star?
Anywhere but the field.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Hatch, Representative Erdahl, I think that's for a different presentation.
What?
I think, Representative Erdahl, that's for a different presentation on the Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail update with, for a different presentation that handout is.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Erdahl, Representative Erdahl.
Even though I'm a little confused, it still fits in. Let me, what are the plans for the West?
Ms. Hatch, we're going to bring the map up to you so you can see it.
We've already hit California.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would like to request that Dan Crome, our passenger rail project director, be allowed to come and respond to that question.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Crome. I'm director of MnDOT's Passenger Rail Office. Regarding the question, that is future or existing Amtrak service to Seattle that's represented there. Our state rail plan calls for enhancement of that service post-2025, additional frequencies to Moorhead, and that's what that's representing.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, it takes care of one area. You know, there's something called the Little Crow Line that runs to the west out to Wilmer, proposed corridor, you know, other possibilities in Minnesota. Just wondering what the plans are for the rest of Minnesota.
Mr. Cron?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in our detailed maps in our state rail plan, we do show more arrows moving to the west to Wilmer, on eventually down to Sioux Falls. We show Mankato as a Tier 1 corridor that hopefully will get some momentum and start working on development of that corridor. So there are efforts to fill into the west, but right now the core connection to Duluth, to Rochester, and to Chicago is the backbone of our system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I just wanted to get on the record that there was more of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Kroon. Ms. Hatch, may I proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next item is another modal investment airport development assistance area. This is a $10 million need in 2014 to support infrastructure needs of Minnesota's public ports on the Great Lakes and inland river navigation systems. There are five public port authorities in Minnesota: the Red Wing Port Authority, St. Paul Port Authority, Duluth Seaway, Winona, and Minneapolis Port Authority. There are also three privately owned ports, Silver Bay, Savage, Taconite, and Two Harbors, a fourth. The project proposals in this category are prioritized based on need, employment generation, and overall economic benefit. This is a partnership program to improve freight handling and efficiency in Minnesota's commercial waterways. Some examples of projects would include sheet piling, a rehab of a barge terminal, stormwater management, modernize of electrical services, and commercial dock site improvements. The purpose of Port Development Assistance Program is threefold. One is to expedite the movement of commodities and passengers on the commercial navigation system. Two is to enhance the commercial vessel construction and repair industry in Minnesota. And three, to promote economic development in and around ports and harbors in the state. The next category of need is in our railroad crossing program. This request is for $19 million for the installation of warning devices at highway rail grade crossings for two separate programs. The first program would be to upgrade existing warning devices that have reached the end of their useful life. We often call this the antiquated signal bonding program. We're looking for $10 million to support that effort. And then also to provide active warning devices, so new warning devices that are active rather than passive, at highway rail grade crossings located in paved county-stated highways throughout the state. And we're looking for $9 million to support that effort. The replacement cost for each antiquated system is approximately $275,000 each. And this would not completely fill the need that we have. In order to be on a full replacement cycle, we need an infusion of about $18 million into that program annually. But this would be a significant help to that program. In the rail service improvement area, we are seeking $10 million to fill a need to provide interest-free long-term loans to regional rail authorities, railroads, and shippers to improve rail facilities and increase railroad shipping. This takes place in three program areas. One is capital improvement loan program. That program provides railroads and shippers that are eligible to receive interest-free loans for capital improvements. Typical projects include upgrading small segments of rail lines, construction and extension of rail spurs, bridge replacement or upgrades, and developing of loading and unloading facilities. Recipients of this funding must meet criteria to protect the investment of Minnesota taxpayers. Second category is the Rail Line Rehabilitation Program, which is a partnership program with rail authorities, rail shippers, and Minnesota Department of Transportation. This program loans money to rail authorities to rehabilitate operating but deteriorating rail lines. The program requires shipper financial participation, and projects must also meet criteria to protect the investment of Minnesota taxpayers. Rehabilitation loans have included 29 state-funded rehabilitation projects. And finally, this also supports the Rail Bank Program. The Rail Bank Program acquires and preserves abandoned rail lines and a right-of-way for future transportation use. And once acquired, MnDOT has the financial responsibility to maintain abandoned railroad property placed in the Rail Bank Program. The next item is safe routes to schools. This is a need for $6.4 million to increase safe and convenient opportunities for children to walk and bicycle to school in communities across Minnesota. This would build infrastructure that increases those options and provides a safe way for them to get to school. A little bit of background about this program is since 2006, the federally funded Safe Routes to School program has provided grants to Minnesota communities to increase opportunities for children to walk and bicycle to school. Demand for the program exceeded funding under the former legislation, federal legislation, Safety Lou, and current and future federal funding is uncertain at this time. In 2011, for example, MnDOT received 82 applications from local schools requesting a total of $23 million for safety improvement projects near schools, but we could only fund about $3.8 million in 16 communities. Providing safe routes to school for Minnesota's children has numerous benefits, including reducing congestion around the school, reducing school transportation costs, and providing an opportunity for physical activity, which decreases obesity, improves health, and supports academic achievement. And finally, we have a need to fund $1 million worth of contaminated site cleanup on a currently MnDOT-owned rail bank property. As I mentioned just a few moments ago, one of the eligible funding categories for the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program is to purchase abandoned rail property to be used at a later time for transportation purposes or for trails for the DNR, for example. We currently have a site that is located in northern Minnesota that has been declared a Superfund site by the Department of Agriculture. And responsible parties have been named as MnDOT, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, and Mr. Huffnagel of the Page and Hill Forest Products. This is the estimate of MnDOT's liability of $1 million, and will also require, once this site is cleaned up, will require ongoing groundwater monitoring.
Members, are there any questions? So Ms. Hatch? Seeing none, Ms. Hatch, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we're going to adjust the agenda here a little bit. We're going to take number five, informational hearing on House File 587 next. Is Representative Falk here? Yes. So Representative Falk, if you want to approach and get your folks at the desk, we will proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And welcome, Representative Falk.
Appreciate that. And committee members, for your time, I appreciate that as well. House File 587 is a capital investment request for the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority. And this is a $10 million request to continue to rehab and rehabilitate a rail line for this Minnesota Valley Regional Rail. The rail connects 16 communities from Norwood, Minnesota, to Hanley Falls. And it's been a really useful project to go and continue for economic development in western parts of the state. And it's also had the side benefit of removing a significant amount of truck travel when we're hauling agricultural commodities to get that those loads off the roads and onto rail. With me, I have Mark Wagner. He is the president of the Minnesota Prairie Line, which is the rail line that operates along this rail corridor. And Bruce Penske, and he's part of the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Coalition. And so I'd like to let these gentlemen continue to speak about the project.
Yes, I want to go first.
Representative Falcon, would you identify, are you Mr. Wagner?
I'm Mr. Penske.
Mr. Penske, would you identify yourself with the tape, please, and proceed with your...
Okay, my name is Bruce Penske. I'm representing the Minnesota Regional Valley Rail Authority Coalition and the shippers along the 94-mile line from Norwood to Hanley Falls, Minnesota. I'm supporting this bill for rehabilitation of the line to 25 miles per hour and the use of heavier train cars. The line has been done about 25 miles to Winthrop, Minnesota, with the main support being from the state of Minnesota and some federal support also for the last approximately 5 years or so. The line is publicly owned by five counties. 16 towns are served, and there are currently 17 shippers along the line. It is supported by all the counties, all the towns, all the shippers, plus various organizations in the whole entire stretch. We believe that completing this line will develop more shipping in the future, maintain current shipping business, and the potential to create new business in this depressed region. Jobs, reduced road wear, safety, and the environment are all benefited by this line. Maintaining and generating new business creates jobs. Less trucks on the highways reduce road wear. Currently, there are approximately 25,000 to 28,000 trucks per year that are not on this highway because they're going by rail. Safety is also improved as less travel on the road is less accidents. Not that there aren't ever any accidents on the rail, but it doesn't come to the same level as on the highways. The environment is improved by the train use also because the engines are run on biodiesel, so there is less gas used and less carbon emissions by the train than by trucks. Some examples of value created by the current 25-mile stretch that has been done. There is one industry that I know for sure that I doubt would still be in existence if they didn't have the service of the train. That isn't been part of the section that is done, and in fact, they are actually increasing their shipping from some years ago to a business that was on the borderline of even staying in that community. There are three industries that have been put in Winthrop, mainly because of the rail being there. Ethanol plant, and not many years ago, that doubled its size.
Heartland Grain Products, and Land O'Lakes. Those are all in a town that had basically nothing 7-8 years ago. A very depressed community that has certainly shown some rebound by having the rain. They wouldn't be there if the train wasn't there. Added information is the use of 25 million pounds of carbon emissions less each year, rather than have trucks do it. Studies have been done by Region 9, that one was probably about 6 years ago, and the University of Minnesota in 2009 of December, that indicate that jobs are maintained and created because of this line. Your packet includes various information on products hauled, less trucks hauled in the last 6 years, counties, shippers, towns on the line, and values added. I urge your support of this bill, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here today. And now I'll turn it over to Mark Wagner, president of the
bill. Thank you, Mr. Penske. Mr. Wagner, you want to identify yourself, please?
Excuse me. Mark Wagner, president of the Minnesota Prairie Line. We are the railroad that operates the property that the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority owns. We work in partnership with the Rail Authority and the shippers to give this part of Minnesota an economic boost. What this rail line does for this region is it helps attract businesses, keep businesses, and it also affects the surrounding areas in that it keeps all of the rail shippers in the whole area more or less honest because they have this option. 10 years ago, this rail line wasn't being operated. In October of 2002, through the MnDOT Rail Service Improvement, the Rail Authority got a loan. The shippers contributed, and we, the operator, contributed to get it to a 10-mile-an-hour standard. What's left are the rails. On this stand here are the existing rails, which are 100 years old. They're called 80 pounds. Basically, they weigh 80 pounds every 3 feet. And the larger rail is what's being put in. That's a 115-pound rail. What that 115-pound rail does is, one, it allows us to increase the speed from 10-mile-an-hour to 25-mile-an-hour, and secondly, it allows us to haul the heavier rail cars, which are North American standard. The old standard was 263,000 pounds on rail. Current standard is 286,000 pounds on rail. This rail line cannot do that on the lighter rail, but putting the heavier rail, it can. And that keeps the industries on this line competitive in the North American environment and keeps Minnesota competitive in the North American environment. So this is a long-term project. It started 10 years ago. As Bruce indicated, the first 34 miles have been completed, and this last December, the speed limit was increased from 10 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour. Now, that may not sound like much, but what that does is it gives the shippers one rail day sooner into the Twin Cities, where it can go over the North American continent, and the shippers to the west in Fairfax, Redwood Falls, Delhi, Echo, Hanley Falls, they would like also to be able to participate in the North American rail market. And so this is a long-term project, but it really is paying dividends in that it's attracting investment to this part of Minnesota that really needs it, and it does provide regional benefit because the vibrance of rail here affects rail served to the south and rail served to the north, keeps those rail rates competitive because this rail line is there. So we appreciate all of the support that you have given in the past. We recognize this is a long-term project. There's 60 more miles to go. The bonding request won't accomplish all 60 miles of it, but it's roughly $500,000 a mile, so the $10 million request would get 20 more miles done. Thank you very much.
I have two items to add, if I may.
Penske, you want to identify yourself, please?
Bruce Penske, from the representing Minnesota Regional Rail Authority. I have a couple items to add to what I said previously on benefits of the current part of the project that has been done. There are two towns on this end, Arlington and Gaylord, which have been on the completed part of the line, that are both developing industrial development parks for their communities. They've purchased land, and they're locating that along the rail line with the thought of generating or getting some more businesses to help these towns. And there is a new shipper being developed right now in Franklin, Minnesota, and that's partly because of the rail also.
Thank you, Mr. Penske. Mr. Wigner, members, are there any questions? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Penske, I'm sorry I came in late. I might not have heard what the contribution from the rail to this project is. I know you're asking for $10 million.
Correct.
What is your contribution?
Mr. Penske?
Whose contributions exactly do you mean?
I suppose the 10 counties, cities on the line, something. Is there any match to the state's contribution at all?
No, there isn't a match. The counties that own this line, in order to, you know, legally they could tax, but in order to do that, they have to have unanimous votes by each county. As you well know, that's not very easy to get. It just doesn't happen. But there is no current match. But all these small towns, and they're all depressed in the whole region, and that's been a problem in the whole state. I understand that. But right now, there isn't, no.
Representative
Becker?
I'm fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Falk?
Thank you. And I think to maybe add to that point that there isn't a local match at this point. I don't know if the counties have the capacity to do that, but the real benefit to the state and ultimately to our taxpayers is the fact that we're removing about 25,000 to 28,000 semi-truck loads per year from our road system. And so when we take those loads off, we save significant resources by reducing the wear and tear on just the highway system. And so we have to look at that ancillary benefit, too, when we look at the full cost analysis.
Thank you, Representative Falk. Representative McNair.
Chairman Ward. Mr. Pinsky, how many total miles in your railroad?
94.
And 16 communities served?
Representative Penske. Mr. Penske.
Yes, 94 miles and 16 towns, five counties.
Chairman Ward. Mr. Pinsky, how many elevators are served?
Mr. Penske.
Boy. Let's defer that to Mark. He has a better handle on that.
Mark Wagner, Minnesota Prairie Line. Currently, there are elevators in Winthrop, Gibbon, Fairfax, Redwood Falls, Delhi, Echo, and yeah, I think that's it. So there's seven elevators.
Chairman Ward, I've seen in rural areas a small spur line develop a community and create jobs. I feel this is a worthwhile project.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to kind of follow up with Representative Gunther. Spoke to. I understand 20 or 30,000 trucks coming off a road is a significant reduction in traffic. But you're serving. I think you. I'm going to go off memory. Well, I wrote it down, but I hope I heard it right. Five counties, 19 cities, and 17 companies. 41 operations of some sort or another. We typically, as a state, economic development or many state particular issues require some kind of a user match. And I don't know why. I understand the 20 to 30,000 trucks, but this $10 million doesn't get the last, it doesn't complete the project. So I guess I have a couple of questions. What elevates yours above everybody else's that would not require a match? Depressed areas in the state are all over. What elevates yours above that particular level?
Bruce Pinsky.
Pinsky.
Representing the authority. I guess the belief in the elevation of the line is there's value to the state. An example, there were some studies done by the University of Kansas in Iowa approximately 8-9 years ago that indicated per ton mile there was about 5 cents a mile savings on the highways. That translates into the current ton miles at about $3 million a year that actually almost directly benefits the state because of the highways. I had another point. I can't remember what it was now. There are values to the towns, and I understand the whole state is depressed and so forth, but there are also environmental values to the state and safety values. And once the rail is done, it's pretty well done. The contract with the operator, which is a subsidiary of TCW, is they have to maintain the line once it's done. So it's not a project that you keep coming back, like a road. Every so many years, you got to fix the road. The road through our town, I think, has been, in my life, been done four times at $1 million a mile. This, at what percentage, I don't have the exact figure, but I know if there's less trucks off the road, there's no doubt that that's going to benefit the state. There's also benefits to industries and jobs. Jobs benefit the state. Any more than you can get, that helps in taxes, there's no doubt about it. Any business that can be created. So I guess we feel that those are the main advantages to this line, and plus it's publicly owned.
Representative Mahoney?
I've got one question and one kind of statement. How many more miles to the line to finish after this section?
Mr. Pinsky?
Bruce Pinsky, there's approximately 60 miles total.
So, Mr. Chair, and before, I was going to say there's... that's another $40 million, I suspect.
Approximately.
Mr. Pinsky?
Bruce Pinsky, yes, that's counting this 10, though. So it would be about another 30 on top. But originally, when we started coming here, certainly with many different faces, I think Representative Hausman is about the only one I remember, but from Lee's old. We asked originally for more, but it just wasn't possible to get in. It was a lot less money than it is now. Prices have gone up, over doubled in the years when we started this project.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one of those rather unique projects. I don't know if there's another like it in the state. Most railroads are private. This is public. And I was just reminding myself what the governance structure is, because we don't necessarily... as you suggest, the issue of a taxing authority, there's no model, perhaps, for this. And it seems it's probably more like what we do, what we did in Thief River Falls, where the state partnered and built a hangar at the airport so that DigiKey could thrive, or the port in Winona so that they could double the tonnage and some businesses on land grow up, or even, when I think about it, wastewater infrastructure in Litchfield so that a dairy company can expand. And that's sort of how I see this. We partner, in a sense, with that whole region with a transportation infrastructure that provides that corridor of commerce to thrive and hopefully... help all of those small communities to do everything else that hopefully they do to invest in their region, including the road system. So I do think it's unique and has been an interesting one to track. And I'm sorry, I missed your first part. I'm assuming you told them how it has transformed the commerce in the region.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Paul.
Thank you. To the members of the committee, too, there's a handout here that talks about just some of the full-time equivalents and some of the part-times that are businesses that are directly related to this rail line and the impact it has had. And I do think the other point that's important to know, as the illustration is the rails have been there for 100 years, and they survived for that period of time. And once we get this completed, the hope is that these rails would survive an equal length of time. And the other point, too, is, we are seeing a significant amount of consolidation in the rail industry. And to have competition here, we're providing just some fairness in the marketplace, because a lot of these rural communities are not served by multiple means of transportation. So when we can actually have this as an alternative to, say, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe's or some of the other major railroad operators, it helps to keep the price or the cost that we pay competitive.
Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, if the testifier would like to speak first, he raised his hand. I would.
Winker?
Mark Wagner, Minnesota Prairie Line. The other thing that makes this project unique is once this investment is made, we, the rail operator, are obligated to maintain it to the condition in which this investment is made. So it's not like we'll be coming back and asking for the same money for the same miles over and over. And the only way we can do that is by having shippers and economic development. So it really is a team effort by us, the rail authority, the shippers, the counties, all the economic development people. But the point is that this is not, we're not going to be asking for operating subsidies and things of that nature. It's basically, this is a capital investment to last 100 years, and we intend to generate enough business to maintain it in the way it's been invested in.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. And Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a couple of questions. The one, you had mentioned that it would be really hard to get the public support in your area. If the people in these towns and counties apparently aren't behind this enough to invest their own money in it, is there a real need?
Mr. Wagner?
I believe that goes back to the rail line was abandoned in 1982. The counties formed a rail authority to purchase the rail line from the railroad that was abandoning it, but as part of their charter, their charter granted by the state said that the only way that the counties, the rail authority, could get a levying authority is if all five counties got 5-0 votes from their county boards authorizing them to do that levy. So as a practical matter, even though they'd want to, you're always going to have one holdout out of 25 that will prevent that unanimous vote. So as a practical matter, even though the desire is there, they wouldn't be able to get all five county board members to vote 5-0, giving them that levying authority. So they're kind of in a bind. So, but the public support and the support by all the communities is great. The coalition, we ran a train that went through each community summer and a half ago, where all the students come out, and we talked about railroad safety and things like that. It is very well supported in these areas.
President Green?
First a comment and then a question. I still would think that if it is as beneficial as you say, they would probably come on board. The other question I have is, you're talking about eliminating a lot of trucks on the road here, and I'm wondering, is there any local trucking companies in that area that would be hurt by this?
Bruce Pinsky. If all the years we've done that, I don't know of a real local one that would be hurt, and there has not been one trucking company that has came to us and indicated that they would be hurt by it. If anything, most of the trucking, and I used to be at one of these industries in the town of Arlington, is hard to come by. A lot of times there just isn't the amount of trucks that are needed in this day and age that's increased that much. So I would say no to that question, and to further answer your question that you issued on the towns and the counties in getting this support, I'd say currently there's probably 90% support by all of them right now. But to get a vote, you need 100%. 100. That's be like if this committee votes on something controversial and every person votes yes. It's just hard to do. It could be asked, yes. That question could be asked of all the counties. We just don't feel, you know, we know of, say, like one board of five commissioners, there's one person not in favor. So there, you know, the whole thing's out the window. And then I would like to respond a little bit to Representative Mahoney's thing where he talked about, different rail lines in the towns and that, you know, and values and why we think it would be good. Every town supports it. Every council, there have been letters to these committees over the years by every county, every council, just about every organization in the whole line.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really know exactly where this line goes. I have an idea of Redwood Falls into town here. Does every legislator along this line support this $10 million request?
Mr.
Bruce
Pinsky?
Bruce Pinsky, yes. We have never...
No, have they?
Support, and every current legislator supports it right now.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mahoney? Mahoney?
it's still early on a Tuesday morning. I guess the chair is a bit confused on a regular basis, kind of like I will be about noon today. Has every legislator that this line serves written a letter, publicly come out for it, or have they just pulled you aside and said, oh, yeah, it's a great idea, get some votes for it?
I guess I'm not sure. Bruce Pinsky, I'm not sure how to answer that, but I know that most of them along the line sign on the bills.
If I could offer this, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Green, you had the floor a minute ago, so I kind of jumped there.
Well, that's okay. I only have one more question.
Go back to Representative Green, please, because he had the floor and he got into another discussion.
Okay.
Green, go ahead.
Just one more concern I have until we're ready to move this along. I was noticing that you guys don't have a Senate author on this yet. Is there any support for this in the Senate? And if so, why is it not authored yet?
Mr. Wade.
Thank you.
Yes, no, the Senate will have an author. Senator Coonan is going to be the main author, and there are four co-sponsors on the Senate side. We just asked them to hold off on the introduction of the bill because we may have to add an up to within the bill language.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain that to me, the up to part of that?
Right. We in drafting the bill, we want to run it through Minnesota Department of Transportation to ensure that the language of the bill works as far as MnDOT helps administer the bonding funds. In the past, there have been issues with language, so what we're trying to do is make sure that it is clean going through. And one of the suggestions they suggested to us is to add this up to language in it.
To mileage.
So in essence, you won't get the entire 94 miles done with the $10 million. So they said add the up to, that way you can do 20 miles. That was the advice we got.
Thank you. Representative Green? Representative Falk, so if I can state of confusion, go ahead now and respond to.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess one of the things that I learned early on is in the House we typically don't comment on what the other body's doing, but I imagine that they'll be moving it through the process over there. And if we have to have the amendment put on this language as well, we can do that. But to Representative Mahoney, too, if you look at the authors at least listed on the bill draft here, it's Falk, Torkelson, Grunhagen, Erdahl, Hausman, and others. And so we do have a strong coalition of both Democrats and Republicans that are served by and whose communities are served by this rail authority. And I just do feel it is a valuable project and would like to see it move forward.
Thank you, Representative Falk. Members? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just a recommendation as you move forward, you might just want to just, I'm just trying to rack my head and just think about how we've done similar things in the past and just the bonding authority and the relationship between the group for the line and their authority and their ability to fund the coalition that you have and its representation here probably moving ahead, and just any kind of participation locally that you might have, I think would be helpful as you move forward with the project. It sounds like that you got a real need out there, and I know that your testifiers are doing a good job just being very honest with the committee of what the needs are and what the costs are. I think there's probably some questions about just exactly the authority that's out there and legally how we'd move that forward with a bond, just because I would probably need to look back and see what we've done that's been similar in the past.
Mr. Pinsky?
Bruce Pinsky, I wanted to add something about it when you talked, Representative Mahoney talked about completion of the line. I guess I see the project, I haven't been on here for just about 20 years in total, I guess a long time. And once we can get to a certain point, you know, it is becoming self-sustainable. So I don't know that money will be needed for every mile of the line. The last, you know, few miles at the end or something might be able to be handled by the the authority at that time. You know, that remains to be seen, but that's the way I see this project going. At some point, just taking it on, when you talk about a commitment from the area, and that at some point where it becomes a little financially feasible. Thank you.
Mr. Wagner.
If I may add one more thing. Julia Rath, the administrator for the Rail Authority, made sure to let me know, to let you all know, that the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority has a website, and on that website there is a video showing the speed being increased from 10 to 25. So this investment that you've made in the past has worked for the first 34 miles. It's doing what it's supposed to do in generating economic investment, and that's what we're asking is to help it continue. This is like a public highway, except it's made out of steel.
Thank you. Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect the testifiers are a little bit surprised today because, of course, this project has been brought to the legislature many times. It goes all the way back to Representative Knobloch as the first person who was chairing, I think, when this issue came before us, and has been funded in increments since then. So obviously we must be a feistier group and expect more or something because it's been a slightly different presentation today, but it does have a long history of funding under kind of a bipartisan support.
Mr. Pesky?
Bruce Pesky, just to comment on that, I've testified at these different hearings for years, and this is the most questions I've been asked in all the hearings combined. So you've done well, and it feels kind of nice to have some questions, to be honest with you.
Thank you, Mr.
Pesky. You commented on if we had a controversial issue and we all had to vote 100%. That never happens here. We don't have controversial issues.
Okay. Well, bring it out to our region and show them how it's done, please.
Representative Albright. Representative Albright.
Be careful what you ask for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, just, I guess, a worst-case scenario that you obviously are considering. What would happen if this request is not approved and fulfilled? What's the outcome? What's the outlook for the rail line itself if this doesn't come through for you?
Mr. Wagner?
If I may, Mark Wagner, President of the Minnesota Prairie Line. We entered into this agreement with the Rail Authority in 2001, a year before the rehabilitation was done. And one of the commitments that we have as a common carrier freight railroad is the obligation to run the railroad. So as a practical matter, we are obligated to operate the entire 94 miles. At 10 miles an hour, you don't make money. It's a losing proposition. So long term, if there absolutely was no will whatsoever to do the remaining 60 miles, at some point down the road, we would have to talk about reducing service, things of that nature. We don't want to do that because the minute you start talking like that, any hope of investment goes away. And so the track record, Winthrop started expanding their plant when the rail was 20 miles away, and they kind of invested on the whim of a hope and a prayer that it would get there, and it finally did this fall. We absolutely got to keep the momentum going because in Redwood Falls, you have a large incubator of businesses there that the rail line goes, and they still are kind of like, really? Really? And so we need to get that, no, it's going to get there, it's going to get there, sort of thing. So, but that's the answer to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right, members, we got one more item of business, and Representative Fitzsimmons.
Yeah, I guess since the testifier said he likes questions, we'll just keep going. No, I keep this going. Just curious, I need you, and perhaps enlightening me a little bit. You talked about the charter and the rail authority and how that needs to be unanimous amongst the five. But correct me if I'm wrong, but each county has a taxing authority. Is there something that would prohibit the counties individually from making contributions to a project like this?
Mr. Pensky.
Bruce Pensky, to be clear, I guess I wasn't before, the Rail Authority, the five members there, they don't have to be unanimous. But to get the money from the counties of five chairs has to be unanimous. You need all 25. So if one opposes it in the five counties, you can't tax for money.
Right, but I think, and I just, this is where I'm, that would be to impose something covering the five counties, correct? That would be if you did something that included all of the five counties. But as an individual, the counties have their basic taxing authority, and so as individual counties, wouldn't they be able to make a contribution?
Bruce Pinsky, it is written in the charter of the authority that all five counties have to vote. Not you can't they can't do it individually. Tax on the rail. So if the rail authority voted 3-2 to ask the counties to vote, they'd have to get the voters from all five counties. That's written in the original charter of the regional rail authority when the line was purchased from the previous operator.
Representative Fitzsimmons? Representative Zinski? Mr. Chair, have the counties ever put it to a vote?
Mr.
Bruce Pinsky? Not like that, no. It's always been, this guy won't vote for it on our board, so, you know, as you all know, most boards have an idea of how most people are going to vote before they vote. And that happens in the counties, too. You know, they've talked about things quite a bit, and they get the feelings of the members, but it's always been, this guy won't vote for it, so what's the point? You know, it's a wasted effort.
All right, members, that was a informational, good information hearing, lots of dialogue, lots of questions, and thank you for that. Mr. Pinsky, Mr. Wagner, thank you for taking the time to come and giving us good information on this. Representative Falk, thank you for bringing it forward.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and committee members, thank you.
Any closing comments, Representative Falk?
Just appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to move on then to Chair Hartman. Okay, well, at this time, we'll take up Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail with Mr. Ungaro. Please identify yourself for the tape, Mr. Ungaro, and then continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm John Ungaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County and Governor Dayton, citizen appointee to the Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail Commission. For those of you who are not familiar with the commission, it is a joint powers board compact that was formed back in the year 2000 with 10 states. The states are Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Ohio, Wisconsin, and, of course, Minnesota. The main purpose of the commission is to advocate for intercity passenger rail improvements, which will result in faster, more frequent, and more reliable passenger rail service throughout the Midwest. The legislative appointees to this commission are Representative Slocum from the House, and the alternate is Representative Beard, and from the Senate, Senator Sieben, and the alternate is Senator Franzen, and the Commissioner of Transportation, or his appointee, who's usually Dan Crum, to attend these events, these meetings, and the meetings specifically, we have one or two meetings a year, usually in Washington, D.C. We like to try to have a meeting back in the Midwest somewhere. For example, last summer, our meeting was held in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The state of Michigan hosted us, and we were fortunate to be riding, I believe, on the first train, the Amtrak service, the Wolverine, that had the newly upgraded 110-mile-an-hour track service. And so we were able to ride a train at 110 miles an hour, first train outside of the Northeast Corridor, that passenger train travel that fast. And it was interesting to see that since that service has gone to 110 miles an hour, exactly what some of the consultants across the country have been saying about higher speed rail is that if you can meet or beat the automobile, your ridership will grow considerably, and I've noticed that the Wolverine ever since has had double-digit increases in their passengers since they've gone to 110 miles an hour. The map that you have in your packet shows you the overall system and what it looks like. of course, the major, the fastest 125-mile-an-hour bus corridors will include those cities that are specifically listed on there. Some of the other regional cities, though, that will also be connected at anywhere between 90 to 110, maybe even as high as 125 miles. Those are also very important to this overall system. And, of course, Chicago is the hub. And if you're wondering how this map was put together, a lot of it basically came from the individual states themselves. Federal Rail Administration, the FRA, requires that counties, I should say states, have to put together state rail plans. And out of those state rail plans, the priority projects in those states are identified. We had a state rail forum here in Minnesota that's been meeting for, I think, at least 4 years monthly, where legislators, county officials, city officials, railroad people all get together and work on trying to move Minnesota's state rail plan forward. As far as the system itself, you look at that network that's in place, the efficiencies, economies of scales, and synergies that result from that are really what is going to make this a successful system. And just to give you a couple examples, we will have modern train sets, uniform train sets, so that the same equipment that can be serviced in St. Paul can be serviced in Chicago or as far as Cincinnati, for that matter. So those kind of uniformities, as well as the cars, the coaches themselves will be very modern, comfortable coaches with the latest amenities and high-tech equipment. For example, they'll all be equipped with Wi-Fi. So instead of wasted windshield time that many of us have to spend in our cars back and forth as we're traveling to work, people will be able to plug in and use that time to and from work as productive time. Connectivity is another key issue. If you look at that map, those certainly in those major cities, what will happen is if you come in on one of these intercity passenger rail trains, you'll be able to step off that train, cross a platform, and hopefully within 5 minutes, you'll be able to catch a light rail train, a commuter train to your ultimate destination. Funding, that continues to be a big question mark. A dedicated source of reliable and predictable future funding is definitely needed for passenger rail, not only for the Midwest but across the country. But over the last 5 years, there has been some good news on this front. The Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act of 2009 did provide annual funding for passenger rail, along with the Tiger grants, as well as the stimulus bill, which provided the most money that allowed much of the build-out that's occurred in the last 5 years to happen. As far as viability for passenger rail, I'm sure some of you may have a picture in your head of, you know, the Amtrak, the 1950s vintage Amtrak, which is not necessarily the model that we want for the 21st century. And I think Amtrak, that managed to survive a starvation diet that Congress has had it on for the last couple decades, now they finally in the last 5 years have been able to buy new equipment, refurbish old equipment, and upgrade many of their rail lines. You're seeing Amtrak really step forward in some of their operations with much better service. There's a couple examples out there in the country where they've adopted a public-private partnership, and I think based on the success of one of those operations, which is the fastest growing from a percentage basis of ridership of any of the Amtrak lines in the country, I really think that's probably going to be the model for the 21st century. return on investment, as far as the federal government, Federal Rail Administration has a very rigorous cost-benefit analysis that each of these corridors meet. The overall benefits of the proposed passenger rail improvements must outweigh their costs. And this continues, if you look at that map again of the overall Midwest, the cost-benefit analysis that has been done on that entire system and the number of jobs created, for example, $20 billion is the estimated cost to build out that entire system. Yet the economic benefits that will result from it are estimated to be closer to $30 billion. As far as jobs created in any given year, construction jobs could be as high as 20,000 jobs. And as far as permanent jobs, up to 75,000 permanent jobs But let me make it clear, that's not necessarily people working right on the railroad. A lot of it is going to be centered around transit-oriented development around the stations, new restaurants, hotels, condominiums, apartments, those kind of jobs. Finally, if you look at the remaining dots on that map, you see what you see really are a number of unnamed cities, counties, and corridors that have invested literally tens of thousands of hours over the past several years or longer in bringing their projects forward from a planning perspective, bringing them forward so that they are ultimately deemed by the Federal Rail Administration as shovel-ready, construction-ready projects. Minnesota, in 2009, on a bipartisan basis, led by Governor Pawlenty, we in Minnesota decided to also get in this game, and there was $26 million put in the bonding bill that year to allow the corridors in Minnesota to move forward on the planning process so we could kind of catch up with some of the other states and hopefully be deemed shovel-ready down the road. The good news is that we've managed to leverage those dollars considerably. For every $1 of state money, we've been able to access roughly $4 of federal money, because it's 80% federal funding that's available for planning and construction of intercity passenger rail lines. The bad news is that fund, after 4 or 5 years now, is pretty well depleted. And the Minnesota projects that are in the planning process, most of us are kind of in the middle of that planning process. So we need to complete that planning process so that we can be deemed shovel-ready. And there is a bill in the legislature, House File 793. Representative Mary Murphy is carrying it to basically mimic the 2009 legislation, roughly the same dollar amount, so that we can move forward. Now, there is a perception somewhat that because Washington, D.C. doesn't have as many dollars as they did a few years ago from the stimulus, et cetera, for construction of passenger rail, that, therefore, why should Minnesota be pursuing this? That is mostly true when it comes to construction. There's not a lot of construction dollars left in Washington, D.C., but there are planning dollars still available. And all three Minnesota corridors that are in the middle of their planning process, they desperately need additional planning dollars to complete the plan so that we, too, have shovel-ready projects. And the importance of shovel-ready projects can't be any clearer than if you look at the colored chart that you have as far as a list of the Midwest states and the awards that they have received. And this is somewhat dated. This is just through May 2011. You can see that those states that had substantially had their planning process completed, they are the ones that receive the substantial construction dollars from the federal government. State of Illinois, over $1 billion. Michigan, Missouri, hundreds of millions of dollars for construction. And then if you look on the back side of this, you can see that because Minnesota got started so late and we haven't been able to complete our planning process, other than the St. Paul Depot that received $40 million, the only other project listed on here is the Northern Lights Express that got $5 million. But since then, I know that there's a couple additional for the river route to Chicago. There's been some funding for environmental on that. There's been some funding we've gotten for both the downtown stations, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I believe Rochester has received some money through this too, but it still just pales in comparison to these significant dollars that you see other states are getting. And I guess since Minnesota only gets 71 cents on the dollar back for every dollar in income taxes that we send to Washington, this would be a great opportunity for us to improve our balance of payments, so to speak, and also it kind of doesn't make sense that we're sending Minnesota income tax dollars to Washington so that states like Illinois, Michigan, Missouri can use our income tax dollars to build high-speed rail and improve passenger rail in their states while we're we're sitting back here in Minnesota still trying to complete our planning process. So any message that I'd like to leave you with today is that the legislation to reinvigorate that fund from 2009 and get another $26 or $27 million for the next 3, 4, maybe even 5 years, that should help us complete our planning process for the three major corridors. And then we're going to have to count on hopefully the federal government being ready to come in with some big construction dollars again like they have over the past 5 years.
Mr. Ngaro, we've got a question, so Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ngaro, you mentioned that there's been some examples of privatization and partnership. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit more? Is there any good models around the country or in other countries that private enterprise have gotten involved in ridership, passenger rail?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, or Representative Detmer, specifically, I mentioned an Amtrak operation that I have personally visited, and that was between Boston and Portland, Maine. It's called the Down Easter, and they have adopted a public-private partnership where the only Amtrak employees on the or involved in the entire operation are literally the crew on the train. Everyone else is they have volunteers, for example, working the ticket stations along that corridor. There is a concession car on the train that is privately operated, and all that revenue then goes to the concessionaire. And there's essentially a board that they have that is made up of private and public officials that oversees the operation of the Down Easter, and they help make the decisions on the Down Easter, its finances, etc. Even to the level that when I mentioned the volunteers, and I know we've experienced the same thing up in Duluth, for example. We have our regional railroad authority up there operates the North Shore Scenic Railroad between Duluth and Two Harbors, and there's like a couple hundred volunteers that we have of old railroad types that just are anxious to be able to go out and work on these trains and help operate this system, actually. And they don't expect any money. They just do this for enjoyment. So the Down Easter has mastered that, because they have these volunteers that not only are working the train stations, but they have volunteers actually on the trains themselves. So if there is a slowdown or if the trains are running behind schedule, these people, these volunteers that are sitting on the train, if it's Amtrak's fault, they're going to hold Amtrak accountable. And when they have the next board meeting, the Amtrak is going to have to be held accountable for why they didn't do this or why they didn't do that. Now, sometimes when you're sharing a line with a freight operation, obviously you get to blame the freight, and that sometimes happens. But this model that Amtrak has out in between Portland and Boston, I think is something which could really be somewhat of a model for the future. Now, we have out east, there are proposals, for example, between Washington and New York. For, true high-speed, 220-mile-plus trains. There's even a maglev proposal out there. Obviously, those would all be operated by the private sector. Japan Railways, for example, they have a proposal in to build high speed between Washington and New York. And with those that kind of population base in that corridor, I think it isn't high risk for a private operation there.
Yeah. Is it Denver?
Mr. Chairman, and just one last question. Does that, when you privatize in that situation, how does that affect the ticket prices? Is there still subsidies going on there, or what goes on with the ticket prices with a privatization of the rail?
Mr. Ngaro?
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, for example, on the Down Easter, the only subsidy that they are receiving is the CMAQ funds. They are essentially air quality mitigation funds that the federal government gives as a means to, because you're reducing congestion by operating trains from automobiles, there's congestion mitigation air quality funding that the federal government does give operations for that, but that's the only subsidy that they are still receiving. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a point in which our nation did have other alternative transportation forms, and then we sort of turned away from it and somehow thought the automobile was going to solve all of our transportation problems, and that hasn't quite turned out to be the case. And the rest of the world and much of the rest of the country, it has begun to understand again the importance of having transportation alternatives. And our chambers, our major chambers, you may recall they were all here, St. Paul Area Chamber, Greater Minneapolis, and Twin West, have a renewed interest not only in public mass transit in a metropolitan area, but in this intercity passenger rail. My St. Paul Area Chamber has been a strong supporter of moving forward with this intercity passenger rail connection. We run the risk of being disconnected from the rest of the country. The coasts certainly are moving rapidly, and other Midwest cities are and are recipients of those federal dollars. So I think this, just as with the public mass transit in metropolitan areas, this intercity passenger rail needs to engage us and our thinking. Or we, I think, run the risk of being sort of, I always describe it as the Wild West town where the train doesn't stop, and it does have economic implications. So appreciate the presentation.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the question of public-private and partnership, I remember I kind of watched fairly closely when Amtrak was formed, and there was at least one railroad that chose to remain private. That was the Southern. Is that still private, or did they eventually go with Amtrak? I only raised that question because of the question that Representative Hittmer raised, because there was one rail line that chose not to to join, at least one.
All right.
Mr. Ngaro,
maybe you don't know
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, I don't know the answer, and I'm looking at the crowd. No one else seems to know for sure the answer, but clearly when it comes to operating trains above the rails, there are models out there that can clearly show the private sector can work in conjunction with the rail unions that will actually be operating the trains, the engineer, conductor, etc. But all the rest of the, from the ticketing, you know, to the concessions, etc., for the private sector to be involved in that, I think it's kind of a win-win situation, and you get more efficiencies. And I can't leave without passing on to the committee encouraging statement that came from the Federal Rail Administration administrator less than 2 weeks ago in Washington. He was giving a speech at Joe Zabel, and he said, looking at that map that you have in front of you, he said, of all the corridors in the Midwest, he thinks that, and the FRA thinks, that the Twin Cities to Chicago corridor has the most ability for the whole system to be, that corridor has the most ability to be the most successful financially of all the corridors, from ridership to the dollars brought in. So I think, if nothing else, today, when you have the administrator of the Federal Rail Administration saying that's going to be in the most successful corridor of the entire Midwest, we should definitely think seriously about continuing our investment in the planning process.
Representative Carlson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think he answered it by not knowing. I was just curious if it survived. I was one when I said I watched that back then. I was always a strong believer in maintaining rail passenger service, and most of the rail lines, unfortunately, were beginning to cut way back, and then ultimately Amtrak was formed to try to solve that problem. But there was one rail line that, at least back then, apparently tried to continue to make it as a private entity, but that was in the southern part of the U.S., so you may not have known about that one.
I'll have to check on that.
That's fine.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The map that you refer to about the existing and proposed passenger train corridors, It's not explicit on this list in terms of what is existing and what is proposed for lines. Could you expound on that?
Mr. Ungaro.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I certainly can when it comes to Minnesota. Obviously, the corridor running along the river from the Twin Cities down to La Crosse, Wisconsin, that is existing. That's existing Amtrak route from the Twin Cities to Duluth. That is an existing Burlington Northern Santa Fe route. And from Twin Cities to Rochester, the point from Rochester heading east to the Wisconsin border, that is an existing rail route, but the stretch from Rochester to the Twin Cities, heading almost a little bit northwesterly, that is not an existing route. Rochester Zip Line is proposing to do a greenfield where it would be a true high-speed rail corridor. In other words, they would build a line that doesn't have any rail crossings on it. There wouldn't, to avoid accidents and allow you to get to that top speed. So any crossings would have to be either a bridge over the rail line or a tunnel underneath. It would be a sealed corridor fenced in, and that's when you can achieve those higher speeds of like 180 miles an hour or more, is when you have that kind of corridor. Now, they're much more expensive to build, but in the long run, that is going to be the future. So if you have the opportunity and you have the right-of-way, it is a smart thing to do, to look at doing that. But for most of these lines, they are existing lines. They have rail crossings on them, and so they have to deal with those existing rail crossings and the safety concerns there. But there is new technology coming. For example, the federal government is requiring positive train control on any line that has passenger rail on it. So in other words, a dispatcher in a station is going to be alerted if anything on the computer shows there's a potential of two trains, or if there's something on the track that could cause an accident. If the train operator themselves does not try to stop that train, the computer in the dispatch center will stop that train and hopefully avoid accidents. So it's technology that's long overdue, but that's, I think, one of the things for the whole rail system and across the country is they've got to catch up with 21st century technology, finally in these last 5 years, because there has been an influx of new money. Now, certainly in Amtrak's case, their equipment is so much better than it was a few years ago, because they were put on a starvation diet by Congress, and they somehow managed to survive. And so I think with this influx of additional money, they are in a position to do much better as we move forward.
Mr. Albright?
What effect does weather have on high-speed rail?
Mr. Ungaro?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I don't quite understand your question.
We live in an environment where... Thank you, Mr. Chair. We live in an environment where snowstorms and inclement weather and ice certainly would have an adverse effect on running a train at 125 plus miles an hour, in my estimation. So to what extent does that prevent, deter, or detract from running a rail line that fast between here and Chicago?
Mr. Ungaro.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, clearly anytime you have extreme temperatures, whether it's 100 degrees, sometimes that you see out east where they actually have to have slow orders because the track is bending in the heat, and when it's 40 below here, sometimes you get the opposite effect. So those are the times where you have to be more careful. As far as snowstorms, for example, I mean, you look at what happens with the Empire Builder when it goes west. I mean, in the mountains, they get 10, 15 feet of snow, and you just have the lead train has a plow on it and plows that snow aside. So, I mean, they are able to clear those tracks in no time. So it's more the extreme temperatures that will have an effect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as an estimation, for running a greenfield line, that you described it as, between here and Rochester?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, that is what Rochester is currently proposing.
And Mr. Chair, in your estimation, what's the cost per mile for that track?
Mr. Ungaro.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I haven't seen the latest figures, but I do know that approximately the cost of doing true high-speed rail per mile is approximately three times higher than it is conventional passenger rail. And conventional passenger rail, if you were to literally build new track, but you're on an existing right-of-way, hopefully, it can be anywhere from $5 million a mile up to $8 million a mile. So multiply that times three, and you get the idea of what true high-speed rail will cost. But again, as I mentioned early on in my presentation, once a train can either meet or beat an automobile in speed, suddenly the ridership starts to improve dramatically. And if you start reaching speeds of 180 miles an hour, that is going to, be something which I guess exponentially will increase the ridership.
Members, we have about 2 minutes left. Do we have Representative Albright?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm complete.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, 2 minutes.
I can do it in 30 seconds. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll be timing, Representative Erdahl.
I think the cost of actually building the rail is one thing, and maybe the easier cost to surmount. But objections have come, or shall I say qualifications have come, because of the cost of maintenance of the line into the future. Do you have any idea what the percent of the fare paid would be to cover the cost in a year of maintenance after it's completed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, estimates for annual maintenance depends, of course, on if you've built a brand spanking new segment of rail corridor, as the gentleman that were here earlier, you can go many years without having to do a tie replacement program or anything. If you're operating on track that, hasn't had a major rehab in 20 years, about every 20 years, you have to have a major tie replacement program. And so, depending on whether you budget it, so a little money is socked away every year for that maintenance when you do a major tie replacement program. But, it has to be at least 10 to 20% you need to try to put aside, so when you do have those major track rehabilitation programs in place, so that you have sufficient money there. And bonding is another option that you can utilize for such a thing, so that you don't necessarily need all the money at once. You pay off the bonds over 20 years.
Mr. Chairman, real quick, maybe I shouldn't have said maintenance, but just operation cost. What do you have any idea how much the fares would take care of operation cost?
Real quick, Mr. Ungaro.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, if I remember correctly from our state rail plan, the MnDOT estimates for the fare box recovery were around 74-75% was the estimate.
Thank you. Members, just a reminder that this Thursday's meeting, the 28th, has been canceled. So just as a reminder, there's no other business before us today. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.